So, counsel, for our second case, can proceed, settle into the table. I'll just call the case at 10:05 on September 12, 2019. Our second case is A-19-0401. So that's Jason Wallace Horseman, petitioner, appellant versus commissioner of public safety, respondent. So just a couple of quick comments. I'm sure counsel are aware and familiar with our procedures, but when you come to the podium, please take time to settle in with your materials and adjust the microphone. We are recording today's proceedings for later use, and then please keep your eye on the clock. The conversation goes quickly. We look forward to talking to you. So with that, counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready. Did I say the appellant's name correctly? Is it Horseman?
Horseman.
Oh, it is Horseman. Okay,
yes,
thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court, counsel. My name is Brent Tunis. I am the counsel for appellant in this matter. And if I could, I'd like to reserve the 5 minutes for rebuttal.
The 5 minutes is yours.
Thank you, Your Honor. This case is about the inexcusable delay on the part of the commissioner in disqualifying appellant's commercial driver's license. We're talking about a delay of over 4 years from a disqualifying offense. And while the commissioner blames this on some kind of computer error, there does not seem to be a dispute that the computer system was in the purview of the commissioner.
What difference does that make?
That's a
great
question. The
reason why there was an error. I mean, I have to say I'm struggling to find any harm to your client. If your argument is the delay in taking away his license, as I read the federal regulation and understand he has two DWI offense convictions, the state didn't have any choice but to suspend his commercial license, and now he only lost it for 6 years instead of 10. How is he harmed?
And that is correct, Your Honor, and that is a fallacy of my argument, admittedly. However, the disqualification was mandated to be made in 2014. And I can address the prejudice issue later. I'm not certain that that is required under, at least under Minnesota law, but certainly the other states, I do admit, the appellate law from other states does seem to suggest some level of prejudice is required. I don't believe all the cases do, but some do.
But you would agree, though, when we look at the constitutional issues you raise, prejudice is required.
I believe under the due process analysis, that is likely, Your Honor.
Okay.
However, under the state constitution, I don't have case law in Minnesota, at least, to give you on that effect, but the states that have addressed that similarly, I think usually they address it in dicta, if I remember correctly, that the similar constitutional language we're looking at. That's Minnesota, I believe, Article 1, Section 8, process without delay. I believe they're usually referring to that in dicta, so we don't have a lot of authority to suggest that prejudice would be required in the state constitutional.
Well, typically, when looking at similar provisions, where there's not case law, as you know, then we'll look to federal law.
Right.
I mean, one of the reasons I asked about that was looking at the kind of prejudice issues in the case where we are looking at the due process, your due process arguments, and the many cases. Now, I haven't looked at all of them. I've tried to look at quite a few. It seems to be this individual focus on prejudice where we would give a lot of deference to district court's findings. And also it seemed that a number of those cases, including the South Carolina cases, involved individual driver's license, which it just strikes me as would be very different from when a commercial driver's license is involved where you have this federal mandate.
I agree, Your Honor. And to the extent that prejudice would be required by the court, I'm happy to address the prejudice in this case. To appellant, I do believe the district court was a little bit short-sighted in its analysis that there was no prejudice. There's testimony to the effect that appellant was, in fact, in college at the time of his second DUI, and he testified, and the district court even said credibly, that he would have maintained that education had he been disqualified in 2014. Similarly, in 2015, the appellant's CDL was reissued to him after the Interlock program. And that, I guess, is the error that was made on the part of the commissioner. In 2015, he then accepted a job with his current employer, Excel, which absolutely requires a CDL. His previous employer did not necessarily require the CDL. The testimony reflected that he was a passenger and that he could have theoretically kept performing that job without a CDL. But taking that job with Excel in 2015 in reliance upon the lack of action by the commissioner and in fact, the reissue of his CDL, I mean, I can't imagine someone gets their CDL reissued and believes that the commissioner has made some kind of mistake. So that is the reliance that we believe is prejudicial here.
Is there any record evidence that he couldn't obtain the job from his prior employer or go back to college when the government finally learned that it had made a mistake by giving him back his license from which he's clearly disqualified under federal law?
Right, Your Honor. There is no evidence that he's not able to apply now. There certainly was no evidence that it's open or available to him, and certainly college would be an option. However, he testified that, you know, now he has a mortgage, he has kids, child support. All these obligations are commensurate with his current income, which he cannot get, even if he were to get that previous job. I know that income to be far lower than what he's currently able to do. So to that, I don't believe there was any record evidence on that front. And I think if you ask the average person, you know, certainly myself, if you ask me, well, would you prefer the, you know, option A or option B? And option A being you can practice law for 3 or 3.5 more years with the understanding that at the end of those years, you're going to have to completely revamp or, you know, you're going to lose your license, some type of major change to your life. Or would you prefer, let's say you can go back to get your MBA now. I mean, I certainly would not want to work those 3 additional years knowing that at the end of that time, I'm going to be left in the lurch. So I mean, I think that's a helpful analogy. I certainly understand the court's reluctance to, you know, make an exception to law for someone with 2 DUIs. I understand that as a...
Well, I don't know that I mean, you're not asking for his license to be reinstated, are you? I mean, I thought that the district court gave your client credit for the 4 years he shouldn't have been able to have the license so that he doesn't have to wait to reapply. Under the federal regulations, can the state be compelled to give him back his license at this point?
Well, I believe the other states did find that. So where they found a constitutional violation, they did reinstate. And that is precisely what we're asking for, is reinstatement.
Were any of those cases involving commercial driver's licenses?
I do believe there was one, Your Honor. That would be the Job v. Louisiana Department of Safety, 94 Southern 3rd, 217. And that was where the motor office waited 2 years after a criminal sentence to suspend a CDL license. So there is authority to the effect that it can be done. I mean, I understand that there's interplay between state and regulatory provisions where, you know, from my client's perspective, that's what he's asking for.
And the Job case found a constitutional violation?
I believe that was the holding, Your Honor. I'd have to check on rebuttal.
You articulate several constitutional violations. Which one do you think is the strongest?
You know, it's a bit of an interesting thing with this case because I think the state Article 1, Section 8 is strong, but I also think the due process argument is strong.
So right to a remedy? That's the one, Article 1, Section 8?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm just familiar with our case law that says that that doesn't independently support relief.
Sure.
So how do you get around that?
So maybe the answer to that is that the court would have to go a due process violation mm-hmm. and like similar to these other cases, have supported their conclusion with a reference to that section. And I just can't see a way to say that that section of the Constitution is being upheld here. There's no qualification language. It's a right to justice promptly and without delay, conformable to the laws. And I just can't articulate a way that that has happened here.
If your client did not have a right to have, I mean, if the law required that his commercial license, that he was disqualified from having that license the minute he was convicted of his second DWI. I still am at a loss of what right does he have to protect at that point? He has no right to that license. And the fact that he inadvertently had it for 4 more years doesn't create the right, does it?
No, it doesn't, Your Honor. But I think it's more of the prejudice that I've talked about that, you know, at some point an individual or a Minnesota citizen has the right to expect that the government has gotten things correctly. And with this reissuance of the license in 2015, I believe, and his testimony is to this effect at trial, that he reasonably relied on the inaction of the government.
Yeah. Isn't the what we'll I'll just call prejudice, I mean, isn't any harm to him remedied by the fact that his alternative request was granted by the district court, and that is that this lifetime disqualification, which we know can be as short as 10 years, will be 6 years in his case.
That is partially
or
true.
Or whatever the remaining years are.
That is partially true. And there is no dispute that he's received, to some degree, he was allowed to drive during those 3 years. But our position, or appellant's position, is that those 3 years, while you can look maybe to someone in a different circumstance, would greatly benefit that individual. But in the appellant's situation, he's become entrenched into his specialty, whereby he's going to be terminated immediately if he loses his license. And he, I guess the other way to put that is he would have much preferred to be able to go back 4 years ago and start to work towards a different profession or subspecialty, like he was doing. He was in college at the time and could possibly have stayed with his previous employer. So I think the standard of review in this matter is important, that the court can reverse if the commissioner's decision was fraudulent, arbitrary, unreasonable, or not within its jurisdiction and powers. And while I understand that, technically the district court was required to uphold because the commissioner's looking at federal and state law and saying, well, I have to do this. However, given the passage of time, I don't believe that's appropriate. I'd like to direct the court's attention to 49 CFR 384.231B, and that's the provision whereby the state must disqualify a driver as expeditiously as possible. And under respondents' interpretation of these laws, that is meaningless. There is no counterplay for or a consequence for the state's failure to do that. And furthermore,
but do we know that? I mean, does the record show whether they're going to be, you know, lose federal funding or have some sort of a consequence for violating the regulations? Is the record say anything about that one way or the other?
No, Your Honor. And second federal regulation on point, I believe, is 49 CFR 384.206A. And that requires that a state conduct background checks of its drivers prior to issuing CDLs, and specifically to check for disqualification, which had that been complied with, that January reissuance would not have occurred. So there's kind of a twofold failure here on the part of respondent in,
Oh, clearly, I agree with you, and I'm sure the state will agree also they did not comply with the statute for whatever reason, computer error or otherwise. But I have a hard time understanding how the state getting crosswise with federal government on terms of these regulations creates a right in your client to something they otherwise are not entitled to.
Right. I don't know what the answer is, but beyond a constitutional violation where the court would, I believe, have the authority to craft a remedy. So these two provisions that I just referenced are in part to protect drivers from stale disqualifications. And, of course, there's no Minnesota case law to that effect, but there is state law dicta suggesting that that is why they were created. So if we essentially read those out of the regulatory provisions, I'm not sure I don't know what the answer is to that, but I don't think that we can interpret the federal regulations as made mandatory on the commissioner by state statute. I don't think we can read that to have no effect if it's not complied with. And I certainly understand that the commissioner believes a computer error that did this, and there's no fault really probably on either side here. But a citizen cannot be expected to bear the brunt and the cost of the error on the part of the government. I don't believe that is supported by the Constitution. In regards to due process, again, it's a little unclear in Minnesota what the applicable framework is. I think it's the Matthews v. Eldridge framework. And I don't appear to have enough time to go into the three-factor test, which is then divided into another test, but I guess in regards to the requirement of prejudice, I think appellant's position here is that while some cases of delay may require prejudice, we're looking at 51 months where that could be a presumptive prejudice because of the amount of delay, and in terms of the context of a CDL where, and I think the commissioner even concedes this fact, anyone with a CDL would be usually terminated from their employment, whereby they are disqualified. So a delay of 4 years is presumptively prejudicial under the context of due process. If I may address the argument that the appellant was not convicted of driving under the influence as defined by Minnesota law, Table 1 of the CFR, as cited in the brief, is where appellant's disqualification was cited. So the provision is, being convicted of being under the influence of alcohol is prescribed by state law. And I would note that appellant was convicted on his second conviction of .08 within 2 hours of driving. And that, as defined by Minnesota law, is simply not under the influence. Subsection 1 is the under the influence conviction, and that was not where he was convicted. So while I understand that the conclusion of that is a bit odd, that's how the statute was drafted, and I think appellant is entitled to rely on that. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Stephen Melchione. I'm an assistant attorney general for the state of Minnesota, and I am here representing the respondent, Commissioner of Public Safety. The core issue here for the court to address is whether or not the 2018 redisqualification of petitioner was arbitrary, unreasonable, or capricious, and whether appellant was harmed by driving a CDL for 3.5 years when he should have otherwise been disqualified. The bottom line here, and what happened when the respondent agreed to backdate the revocation and when the court ordered the same, is that appellant will not serve a single extra day of disqualification, which is the harm that has been cited in all of these other cases. So I think that's kind of our central factual focus. Because of the backdating, because of the way respondent went about correcting its own error, appellant is not going to serve a single extra day of disqualification, and in fact will serve 3.5 years less disqualification than he otherwise should have.
How do you address the appellant's arguments that may in fact be true, but there are collateral prejudicial impacts that the court should have considered in determining whether, in fact, this decision is arbitrary and capricious?
I think the district court did consider those factors and considered the testimony. I think when you look at what the primary harm that appellant was alleging is that appellant took this new job that he is no longer qualified for. The fact is, everyone who has a CDL disqualification is subject to losing their job. That is true across the board because most people who have CDLs use them for employment.
But he wasn't at the time of the second DWI. Wasn't he working for an employer for whom he didn't have driving as part of his responsibilities?
And that's precisely why appellant has not suffered the harm that you see in the Wilson case. In the Wilson case, the driver had changed her entire profession. She had gotten her CDL during the delay and become a bus driver, which she would then lose her entire profession. Appellant can maintain his general profession as a lineman, just not as the higher paid troubleman. He can go back and be a lineman for the county, which is what he was doing at the time of his second conviction. So he's not being entirely precluded from the field. And again, being inconvenienced is not the same as a constitutionally cognizable harm, because I think we recognize that everyone who loses their CDL is subject to potentially losing their employment. That is one of the collateral consequences of these lifetime CDL disqualifications that are required under federal law. So I think we're fairly clear that the real decision, and I think there was some confusion in the briefing initially, was I'm not here defending the failure to disqualify him in 2014. The state admits, well, 2015, he was disqualified in 2014. That is the factual record that the district court found, is that he was, in fact, disqualified in 2014 based upon his driving record and all of the submissions to the district court. What happened then was when he applied for ignition interlock, that disqualification came off and was never placed back on. So when he graduated ignition interlock in 2015, the CDL disqualification was not replaced, which then allowed him from 2015 to 2018, about 3.5 years, to drive, to have a valid CDL license in the state of Minnesota.
So one of the arguments the appellant makes is the factual findings for the reasons for the department's delay aren't supported by the record, but do we even have to address that?
I don't think you do. The respondent admits that it was an error. It was an error entirely within respondent's own department. It had nothing to do with anyone else. The respondent is admitting that it was an error. It was an inadvertent error. And there, because petitioner does bear the burden in these cases, petitioner hasn't shown anything that it was an intentional or a malicious error. So I think we have to assume it's an unintentional error because that's what we have admitted to. The question then is in 2018, when we find this error, what is respondent to do about it? And respondent has been required by federal law to disqualify him for 10 years. And respondent has been in derogation of that responsibility for 3 years and is now attempting to fix it. And the fact is, when we come to this due process analysis, appellant received notice and an opportunity to be heard, which is why this doesn't fit within the Eldridge framework, because he received the notice and opportunity to be heard in 2010 and 2014 and 2018 when he filed the 17119 petition that gave us this case. But in 2014, both the criminal case and the implied consent case challenging the validity of the revocation at its core was contested and an appellant lost. He then also filed the declaratory judgment action in Olmstead District Court that was discussed on the record. So he's had multiple hearings, multiple opportunities to be heard. This is not a pre-hearing revocation, which is why Matthews v. Eldridge framework simply doesn't fit. I would love it if it did, because the Matthews v. Eldridge framework in this context is extremely beneficial to respondent, because the personal interest affected and the state's interest have both been litigated to extremes by the court. And the second factor of risk of erroneous deprivation, there's none, because he's already lost the challenge to the validity of the revocation in 2014.
How do you respond to the argument that counsel made that the 2014 conviction was not for being under the influence of alcohol, and so the lifetime disqualification regulation doesn't apply?
Well, I think the district court substantially agreed with respondent's argument, but the district court's essential finding there was the statute is driving while impaired, and all of the subdivisions there are driving while impaired. Whether you call it impaired or under the influence, everyone knows what that means.
But the regulation, to be fair, talks about being under the influence. And I'm looking at the statute, and while the title of the statute is driving while impaired, there are definitions of what that means, one of which is the person drives while under the influence of alcohol, which is exactly what the federal regulation says. And another way that someone drives while impaired is if they're driving with the alcohol concentration of 0.08. Isn't there an argument that there's ambiguity about what it means to be driving under the influence?
I don't think there's ambiguity for two reasons. First, in this case, appellant testified that he understood an 08 conviction. That's on page 26 of the transcript. He understood that an 08 conviction would impact his CDL, that he couldn't keep getting 08 convictions and maintain his CDL. He thought that he would not have a CDL disqualification because he pled to a misdemeanor instead of a gross or a felony. There's no basis for that. So I don't think appellant's actual confusion about his disqualification comports with what appellant is arguing.
Well, I think he's arguing right now is that this isn't a conviction. The
right.
0.08 is not a conviction while driving while impaired or driving under the influence. And in fact, it doesn't say that.
And that's the second part of the argument. And I think that's a point well taken. But the federal regulation doesn't just say a conviction for driving under the influence. It says under the influence, comma, as prescribed by state law. There's a separate federal regulation, 23 CFR 1225.4, which is cited in our briefing. That federal regulation requires all states to adopt a 0.08 per se DWI violation. And because the feds are requiring us to have this 0.08 violation to then come back and say, but the .08 violation doesn't count for your CDL disqualification, it is both an absurd result and doesn't comport with the purpose behind what the federal government is doing in requiring nationwide .08 adoption. And in fact, 49 states do have a .08 level. So it was an effective program. And the one state that doesn't have a .08 level is .05. So everyone is .08 or more creates a DWI violation as prescribed by state law because it's required as a condition of getting federal highway funding. So the federal government required the states to define it this way, to use the .08 as the definition. So to then say that, but they meant to exclude that violation from the table in 49 CFR 3.51, I don't think comports with a kind of an all-inclusive reading of the statute. We have to read these provisions in harmony with one another. And I think the district court made the good point that under the influence and impaired are interchangeable terms. And to the extent that .08 is driving while impaired as opposed to driving under the influence, I think it's a distinction without a difference to that point. But again, I think the appropriate analytical framework for us here today when we're talking about due process is substantive due process, because this is a post-hearing revocation. And the substantive due process threshold is much higher, and especially when we're talking about not a challenge to the statute itself, but a challenge to the executive action. That's the shock the conscience standard from Wiseman. And I think while we would all prefer this mistake did not happen, we understand that mistakes do happen. And I don't think this mistake shocks the conscience. I don't think it rises to that level. All of the extra jurisdictional cases that appellant cites don't stand for the simple proposition that that an extensive delay results in an automatic returning of your license. In fact, the one case that was cited here today was Job. And if you look at what happened in Job, the court specifically found, and the district court took note, that the court in Job said the delay for the CDL disqualification violated due process because it went into effect after it should have expired. So he was serving more revocation, more disqualification than he otherwise would have. What the respondent has done in this case is match those end dates. And that's what you see in all of the cases, in Davis, in Job, and here in Minnesota, in Greenlee, is essentially looking at what's the end date. Had this been done correctly, with no mistakes, what's the end date of the disqualification or the revocation? As long as those match, we're okay. It's not a due process violation. The due process violation comes into effect when you're extending the revocation such that, so in this case, 2014 to 2024 would be when the 10 years runs. If the commissioner were disqualifying him into 2025 or 2026, that would be the problem. That would be the harm. The harm is on the back end. It's not what happens to you during your disqualification, because during that 10-year period, he shouldn't have been able to drive a CDL or go work for Excel and make an extra however many thousands of dollars a year. That's all a benefit that inured to him. And the fact is, he's still employable in the field as a lineman for the county, because as was admitted by appellant during his testimony, he didn't need a CDL for that position. And that's what the district court found. And whether or not those harms exist and what kind of harm exists, that is uniquely within the purview of the district court after hearing the testimony and looking at all of the evidence that was submitted. So I think that's where we have to get to that due process analysis. And again, our correct analytical framework is substantive due process. It's not Matthews v. Eldridge, because this is not a pre-hearing revocation. Additionally, I think it's important to note that a portion of the months of delay was when he was on the Ignition Interlock program. So when we're talking from 2014 to 2015, that portion of the non-disqualified time doesn't actually count because he was on the Ignition Interlock program when he wasn't able to drive a CDL. He's getting credit for that. He was enrolled in a program that allowed him to drive. So that time should not be counted against him. It's really the 42 months, 3.5 years, from 2015 to mid to late 2018. I think additionally, one of the examples specifically for us, there isn't much case law on this in the state of Minnesota. And the fact is, there's no case law in Minnesota that says our due process guarantees in the Minnesota Constitution, in this context at least, are more expansive than the federal due process guarantees. So we should look to those federal cases as providing us the standard for how we interpret what that due process does mean. Additionally, back to the comments made by appellant about respondent potentially being in violation of other federal regulations, that is an issue between the state and the federal government, and the state may or may not have to answer for it depending on the circumstances. But that is not, those federal regulations do not, sua sponte, create a constitutional right on appellant's behalf. And, excuse me. And lastly, I would note that the only case that we have that even comes close to this in Minnesota is Greenlee. And in Greenlee, while the revocation was lifted, the license was reinstated, it is precisely because the time for the revocation would have otherwise expired had it been implemented correctly. So while the ultimate holding, when you read the bottom line of Greenlee, is license reinstated, it's because it was essentially backdated and had expired. So that's really the best guidance we have here in Minnesota from the Supreme Court. It is a non-CDL case, but I don't see why that framework wouldn't also apply here, which is exactly why the respondent agreed to and the court did backdate. Thank you.
If I may, I'd like to first address one of the factual citations made by respondent. He pointed out that on page 26 of the transcript that appellant, in fact, understood that the .08 conviction was subject to the Table 1, the disqualification. The testimony, in fact, was that he believed that it was not subject to the lifetime ban. And the testimony reflects that one of the reasons he entered into that plea was to avoid that result. So I just wanted to clear that up. And to the point of respondents' argument about whether appellant has been harmed, by respondent's own admission, anyone with a CDL that will lose that CDL is likely going to lose their job, or overwhelming majority of those people. I think that's why it's even more important that the government or the state here complies with the federal regulations to prevent these stale disqualifications and to prevent the issuance of a CDL that's not, otherwise they're not entitled to. And to the point that he can now go back and be a lineman, my understanding is that there's a huge difference between a lineman and a trebleman. That's like saying that I can go back and be a law clerk, and that's all fine.
And I think you told us in your initial argument that there is not a record on any of this. You're just...
Correct, Your Honor. I think there's...
hypotheticals.
I think the assumption is that he could go find employment somewhere as some different specialty of what he does, but certainly not what he's currently doing.
He can't drive the truck.
Correct. To the procedural due process point, respondent's argument on that front is that anything up to 10 years is fine, as long as there's, I guess, no showing of intent on the part of the commissioner. A delay of up to 10 years is perfectly fine, and I think that the case law from other states would suggest otherwise.
Well, if there's a delay of 10 years, I think the respondent would say, then you're never going to have a disqualification because it wouldn't be fair to extend beyond the period that you would have lost it if the state had followed the rules.
Certainly, but I'm not comfortable with the idea that a delay of 9 years and 11 months comports with both the Constitution and the state regulations, state statutes and regulations. I just don't think that's a fair result. And
this gets to something towards the end of your argument. You were talking about presuming prejudice given the length of this delay. Do you have any cases that support that?
I do not, Your Honor. And I guess to that point, like we discussed a little bit, there's not a lot of case law here talking about CDLs. And I think that would suggest that these states are monitoring their CDL programs pretty closely, given the federal regulations and the federal funding and what's at stake here. So I think that makes it all even the more important that these are followed. So back to the point that under the influence is not a conviction subject to the Table 1, I think, Justice, you accurately stated it's the identical language. How can we craft a result whereby under the influence does not mean it means something else than what it says. And I don't believe respondent has pointed to any case law that would suggest that a conviction for .08 is under the influence as defined by Minnesota law. I mean, there's no showing required under that statutory subsection of impairment. And I believe that is what the table was trying to capture. If you look at Table 1, the CFR that we're talking about, there's other offenses enumerated there. And I can't remember exactly what they are, but I think
one of them is refusal to take a test, which when you have a test refusal, there's no evidence of impairment either, is there? And in the same way there is with under the influence as the subject crime.
Certainly. But I think it's important that that table cites, well, .04 while driving a CDL, for example. Well, it's hard to say that that Congress intended .04 to mean a specific BAC, but then they also intended the phrase under the influence as defined by state law to mean .08 always. Had they intended that, then they would have put .08. So, and I realize that possibly there's some ambiguity here and some miscommunications between state of Minnesota and the federal table, but I believe that's not appellant's burden to bear. And furthermore, to the idea of prejudice being presumed, one remedy that the court could look at would be that if an appellant can show some level of the state not following federal or statutory law and then can make a presumptory showing of prejudice, then I would suggest that this burden should be shifted back to the state to prove that did not happen. Thank you.
Our thanks to counsel. The matter was well briefed and well argued. It is now submitted to the court for its decision, and we will issue a decision within the statutory time frame. Thank you.
Thank you.